Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at PEM.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. The Boston City Council is clearing the way for a new industry today.
This ordinance is not for large corporations to set up shop. It's for small minority and immigrant entrepreneurs who want to share their food and their culture with their community.
And that fits our DNA, according to a local author who claims Boston has a 400-year history of innovation, from Subways to chocolate chip cookies.
The oatmeal raisin cookie was the leading cookie in the United States. Think about how terrible that is.
And on this last day of Women's History Month, we revisit a conversation about another historic change, women's fight for the right to vote.
This is the last battle for the last state needed to ratify the 19th Amendment to make it enter the Constitution, which would give the vote to every woman in every election in every state.
Next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The Boston City Council essentially created a new business opportunity today. If you're a cook and you've wanted to sell food out of your home in Boston as of this afternoon, you can. The council voted just a couple of hours ago to change city law to allow people to sell cottage foods out of their own kitchens. That's things like cookies, pastries, cakes, pies, churros, tortillas, dried fruit, pasta, granola, jams. Notice those are all things that don't spoil easily or require special temperature to store. Boston City Councilor Julia Mejia sponsored the new ordinance, and Andre Antazari, a city planning student at BU, advocates for home cooks, is a home cook himself. Councilor Mejia, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here with you all today.
Great to have you. And Andre, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So, Councilor Mejia, I'll start with you. Why did you lead on this issue? Why was it important to you?
Well, you know, I think the question would be for Andre. He was the one who inspired us to do so. We have the way we work in our offices through a policy, people-centered lens. And so Andre came to us with an idea and a vision. And as with everything that we do, we take the lead from the people who are living the realities and doing the work. And I just thought it was such an amazing opportunity, especially during COVID, to be able to create opportunities for small at-home entrepreneurs to be able to supplement their income and find ways to make a living during these times. And, you know, Andre was really the inspiration behind it all.
So, Andre, tell us, what brought you to approach Councilor Mejia about this?
So my effort in this really started with my own frustration with the process. I moved to Boston a couple of years ago and wanted to start a cottage food operation, found out that this process wasn't in place, going through the Inspectional Services Division, going through the Zoning Department. It was just a frustrating process, and then I really targeted that frustration into advocacy, learning, meeting from others, researching the state law, and then ultimately so grateful that Councilor Mejia took this call to action to support and benefit the vibrant food entrepreneur community in Boston.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Councilor Mejia, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, I'm the chair of small business and workforce development. So as the chair, I saw this as an opportunity to ensure that smaller local entrepreneurs would be able to thrive beyond COVID. So That was also one of the driving forces behind our desire to wanted to support this wholeheartedly.
And am I understanding that correctly, that one of the things this does is essentially reduce the barrier to entry if you want to cook and sell food, because it costs less to do that out of your home kitchen than it would to have to, for example, get commercial kitchen space. Is that right, Councilor Mejia? Is that part of the motivation here?
Absolutely, absolutely. What we see in our community, particularly for entrepreneurs who have very little access to capital, the startup cost of just being able to operate a business can be cumbersome, and especially if you don't have the money to have a brick and mortar. So the idea is people are able to incubate right out of their own kitchens, so that they can hopefully occur the type of capital that they need to eventually roll out into a business. But this is a low cost and very limited bureaucracy, if you will. They can just go to City Hall, apply for the permit. It's as simple as making sure that you take a food safety class. There's a letter that you sign confirming that you have understood the labor laws, the fire safety, all that, and then you get your little sticker and you're off in your merry way.
Andre, what does this mean for you?
This is huge, not just for me, but for people that either have a side business or are aspiring to one day have a brick and mortar and want to test their product. I am Iranian American, so the cottage food that I make is fruit leather, and it's a dehydrated fruit strip that I, when I was in LA, I had a cottage food operation selling to my community, selling at farmers markets, engaging with others through this beautiful aspect of food. And now that Councilor Mejia sponsored this and is moving forward on it, it opens up so much opportunity, not just for economic development, but your local community, engaging with your local community through food.
And Andre, starting from today, how long will it be to go through the process that for you that the city has now put in place until you can bring your fruit leather to market?
So luckily, I already have a food safety certification. So once this law passes, I mean, it passed today, but it takes 30 days to go into effect. The day it goes into effect, if you have your certifications, your food safety certifications and mass allergen awareness training, you can go, and hopefully the turnaround is rather quick from the Inspectional Services Division. And I know they're leaning into the work on making sure that process is swift and equitable for folks that are applying. So I hope the turnaround is rather quick, but I know they're still developing that this month.
So are you talking about a number of weeks between food safety certification and going through Inspectional Services Division?
Yes, that's what I anticipate, a few weeks to a month, yeah.
And Councilor Mejia, is that your expectation too, that this will be a fairly fast turnaround?
Yeah, so during our working sessions, we were fleshing out some of the details, and so the way it was written is that 30 days after it's passed, and then you would have 30 days to be for the law to actually go into effect. So, which is an advance warning for a lot of people who are hearing this for the first time. They better go get their food safety certificates and all other things lined up so that they can just head over to City Hall to go through the process. But we do and anticipate that it'll be a seamless process.
Let me stay with you for a second, Councilor Mejia. So this allows people to make and sell cottage foods that don't need to be temperature controlled or perish easily. Is that sort of it, or is this the first step in a process that might then allow the city to permit people to sell more restaurant-style foods like tacos or soups or noodles, curries? What do you think?
Yeah, you know, this is one step in the direction to help support at-home entrepreneurs, and whether it be residential kitchens. We actually initially thought that we would open it up to, like, barbers and tailors, you know, and things of that nature. But we figured we start off with the residential kitchens because, at the very least, on the state law level, that there was the laws already in place for something for residential kitchens. But my hope is, and my vision, and I do hope that we can get to a point like this, is that we offer opportunities for other types of at-home entrepreneurs.
Andre, what are you most excited about what's possible for you today that wasn't yesterday?
I am so excited to go to a farmer's market this summer in Boston or next summer in Boston and see the local food producers in those areas, meeting others in this space, and giving opportunities to folks that didn't have that before this was passed.
Well, that is Andre Antazari. He's studying city planning at BU, advocates for home cooks, and is a home cook himself who will soon be selling you some dried fruit leather. And Councilor Julia Mejia of the Boston City Council, thanks to both of you.
Thank you so very much. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Bye. Great to have you both. So it's been a busy week for the state and local politics. We just heard about something that happened at the Boston City Council level today. Lots else going on, and it is only Wednesday. It is that kind of political season. Acting Mayor Kim Janey of the City of Boston hit the ground running this week. Jeff Turco is headed to the State House to represent the 19th Suffolk District. That happened this week. And a new poll shows that maybe Governor Baker is holding on to his Teflon reputation. So we thought we'd ask somebody to come run it down for us. Political playbook author Stephanie Murray. Stephanie, thanks for joining us again. Great to have you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's start with Kim Janey. There is a lot there, and I want to start with something that you reported in the Massachusetts Political Playbook today, which is that Acting Mayor Kim Janey has tapped political operative Kirby Chandler to serve as her campaign manager. I almost expected you to have a headline over that that said, "She's running." That's a pretty serious sign, right, Stephanie?
That's right. And this is according to three sources, you know, in Boston around City Hall, who confirmed this to me, that the acting mayor has hired a campaign manager. She hasn't made any official announcements yet about whether she'll seek a full term as mayor in the fall. But, you know, all of the indicators are kind of shaping up to look that way. She's hired Doug Rubin and Northwind Strategies, a pretty well-known consultant in Boston, to handle the transition. And she's continued to raise money even after the transition from city council president to acting mayor took place. And she's acknowledged herself that she's going to make a decision in the coming weeks. But, you know, something that all of the other candidates running for mayor are paying attention to, and picking a campaign manager is a very significant step towards, you know, launching a full campaign.
She has done a lot in a little more than a week. Can you run us down some of the big steps she's taken or announcements she's made?
Sure. So Acting Mayor Janey's already kind of flexing that muscle that comes with being the incumbent mayor, which will make her such a, you know, a significant force in the race if she decides to get in. She announced that the city of Boston's moving $50 million into the rental relief fund, something partially due to the American Rescue Plan that President Joe Biden just signed. She rolled out a new program to give free MBTA passes and Blue Bike passes to some workers in city neighborhoods in Boston, you know, kind of a free transportation pilot program. She's been involved in the vaccination effort. She's been, you know, touring schools, talking about school reopenings. So something that has been interesting to me at the beginning of the acting mayor's tenure is that she, in her Twitter bio even, it says not acting, doing. And so I think what she's trying to signal by, you know, doing all of this and rolling out her agenda is that she's not just going to be a placeholder for the former mayor while the race gets underway heading into the fall. She's really going to be an active leader in Boston.
So you mentioned the free MBTA pass program. Here she is during its unveiling on Monday.
By doing this, we hope to ensure that there will be more equity as we not get back to normal, but get to a more equitable Boston.
She has talked about equity. When she joined us a couple of days after her swearing in, she said she was going to focus heavily on equity. And there she is referring to this as an equity program. It's also encroaching on the territory of another powerful candidate, Michelle Wu of the Boston City Council, who has been talking about free tea for a number of years. Are there twofers going on here, or do you see this more as right now Acting Mayor Kim Janey is rolling out a set of initiatives, and then comes maybe a campaign?
I think that, you know, the campaign is more of a matter of when and not if. And so everything that the acting mayor does over the next few months, you know, will be towards building a campaign platform. And being the acting mayor is a pretty good position to start in if you're running for a full term. That worked for the late mayor, Tom Menino, who was acting mayor, you know, before he won a full term, stayed in office for a long time. And this really has the potential to shake up the race. A bunch of candidates jumped in after it became clear that Mayor Walsh was leaving to go to the Department of Labor. But I should note that Michelle Wu and fellow city councilor Andrea Campbell were already in the race and were already kind of prepared to run against an incumbent. So it'll be really interesting. One thing that I might, you know, is what might be having the acting mayor kind of slow down and not jump in just yet is that once she gets in, everything that she does as the acting mayor is going to be judged, like you said, as a twofer, as the acting mayor and as a candidate in the race. And so that it's going to be kind of a different spotlight and a different environment once she does launch a campaign, which seems like she probably will.
Yeah, to that point, Michelle Wu announced all the way back in September, so months and months ago now. I want to pick up on the second part of what you said, Stephanie, which is that there is, it's not that races and campaigns aren't serious, but there's also serious business before Mayor Kim Janey, especially around the coronavirus. And there are going to be heavy decisions to make that will be focused on public health and not on campaigning. During a press conference yesterday, she mentioned she's considering more stringent coronavirus restrictions in Boston amid this continued rise in cases. Here she is.
I think it is troubling any time we see an increase in activity, and so we will continue to watch closely so that we can adjust if we need to roll back some of the loosening of the restrictions that have already happened at the state level. Right now, I'm working closely with our chief to see if that is the direction we need to take.
So one of the things that was that Boston Mayor Marty Walsh often did was stay a step behind the state, so delay another step to reopening. Roughly, Boston is now on track with the state's reopening. As acting mayor, does she have all the power she needs to walk her own path on this? And I also wonder, you know, things like Fenway now being open, TD Garden, does it make it harder to walk things back than it was when Mayor Walsh was serving?
Well, this is sort of the catch-22 of being the acting mayor in the middle of a pandemic. You know, it gives you a leg up as the incumbent if you decide to run. But on the other hand, you're tasked with these really, really serious decisions. Mayor Walsh, when he was holding the city kind of a step back behind the state when it came to reopening, still, you know, had a lot of goodwill, was very popular. It'll be interesting to see because there's so much that goes into it. You know, if you put more restrictions on restaurants, then you're going to frustrate restaurant owners and people like that. If you start to close things that have been open, people feel like there's kind of a sense of normalcy coming back. It could frustrate them. But on the other hand, I mean, we just had the director of the CDC a few days ago say that she felt a sense of impending doom. Those were her words when it came to looking at the coronavirus numbers across the country. Massachusetts is not immune to that. Cases are rising here. And so the acting mayor is certainly in a tough and really pivotal position in responding to the pandemic.
We're talking to Stephanie Murray of the Massachusetts Political Playbook, doing a roundup of a lot of politics this week. Stephanie, let's turn to Jeffrey Turco in the 19th Suffolk District. Last time we talked with you, it was when he had won the primary for that special election. Tell us where we are.
So Jeffrey Turco, a Democrat from Winthrop and Revere, is going to head to the state house and fill the seat that used to be held by House Speaker Robert DeLeo for about 3 decades. He just left the state house late last year to go take a job at Northeastern. And this was a really interesting race. And so what happened here was most of the action was in the primary a few weeks ago, which is often the case in most elections in Massachusetts because the state is so blue. And this is an interesting political wrinkle because Turco is a Democrat, but he has, you know, expressed some anti-abortion views. He supported President Donald Trump in 2016. And so he was certainly, you know, the most conservative Democrat in that primary field at the beginning of March. But the other candidates who were kind of more to the left, more progressive, shared views on things like immigration and other things, they ended up splitting the vote, which helped Turco, you know, propel to victory in that primary. And then it was pretty much no question that he was going to win the election on Tuesday. I think he got 57% of the vote, which is a pretty wide margin.
And will this, I don't want to say that any one elected official doesn't matter. Of course they do. But will this one change matter in the balance of the state legislature?
You know, the state legislature, especially the House, does tend to skew more moderate than, you know, kind of statewide politics, or, you know, the loudest voices are often the progressives, but the majority is usually quite moderate on Beacon Hill. So this will add to that. I think one thing that it did kind of contribute to is just the frustration among progressives to get some wins in Massachusetts. They were successful in 2018 in a few state legislative races and, you know, higher offices than that. But in 2020 in the fall, most of the progressive Democratic challengers to state House incumbents lost. And this Turco winning this race, they viewed as kind of another a loss in the spring. And I should note that it was a pretty quick and low turnout election because Speaker DeLeo left in late December. It triggered a special election that only lasts a few weeks. And turnout is usually quite low in those elections, which it was this time around.
All right, so let's turn our attention to Governor Baker. There's a new poll out, and his approval ratings are back up. The poll is Suffolk Boston Globe survey. It's up from a UMass poll earlier this month by 20 points. And that was after that poll had showed that the governor's approval ratings had dropped 26 points. So right now, in answer to the question, overall, do you approve or disapprove of the job Charlie Baker is doing as governor, 67% say they approve. What do you make of that? And then we will go into some of the other questions from that poll, too.
This is a really fascinating poll. And what I think it shows is that now that the vaccine rollout has smoothed out, people are getting their vaccinations, eligibility has opened up to more people, voters are giving Baker more of a benefit of the doubt for how he's handled the pandemic. You know, just looking through these numbers, he has a 67% approval rating overall, but when it comes to how he handled the pandemic, he's at 71%, which is, you know, much higher than that UMass poll and a poll from the COVID States Project, which is a collaboration of a few different universities that are studying how governor's approval ratings and all sorts of other things have changed over the course of the pandemic. That had him lower too. So it seems like now that the vaccines are more on track than they were at the end of February, this has changed. And that tracks kind of with the polling. Those polls we saw from a few weeks ago, they were conducted at the beginning of March. And this poll we're talking about now, conducted at the end of March.
Although there is still a gap, 71% approval rating overall on his handling of the pandemic, but 58% approval rating on his handling of vaccine distribution.
Exactly. And I think that shows how much it really dented the governor because, you know, some of the most high profile failures of his administration have occurred during this vaccine rollout. I think the one that we all remember is when the vaccine website crashed on that first day that people were supposed to log on and book appointments. They went to click and all they saw was an orange octopus with a question mark over its head and no way to book the appointments. And that, you know, he took a real political hit for that because as somebody who pitched himself as a good manager when he ran for governor and as governor, the vaccine rollout wasn't managed very well.
In a sentence, is the denting, to use your word, enough that you expect to see a big governor's race this next time?
That is a great question. I think you can expect to see a big governor's race no matter what. Governor Baker hasn't said that he plans to run for a third term yet. It's something that he's thinking about. And I would say don't hold your breath. I went back and looked at when he announced for when he was going to run for his second term, and that was all the way in November. So if he sticks to that schedule, we still have a few months to go. But Ben Downing, a candidate for governor, is already in. Senator Sonia Chang-Diaz, state senator, is eyeing it. Mm-hmm. And then everyone's wondering what Attorney General Maura Healey is going to do.
All right. But no breath holding. That's Massachusetts political playbook. Right. Author Stephanie Murray. Stephanie, thanks.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Radio Boston. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to dig into 400 years of Boston-based innovation. I'm Tiziana Deering. Welcome to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. If you think about some of America's greatest innovations, so social changes, inventions, chances are they probably originated in Greater Boston. In fact, we are the leading city in the country in terms of generating world-changing ideas, from self-government to the telephone, modern surgery, vaccines, even, get this, chocolate chip cookies. Or at least that's the case made by Professor Robert Krim of Framingham State University and the founder of the Boston History and Innovation Collaborative. He is the author with Alan Earls of the new book, Boston Made, From Revolution to Robotics, Innovations That Changed the World. He joins us now. Professor Krim, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana.
All right, so I'm a homer, right? I'm all in on this, Professor Krim, but maybe in an unbiased way. Tell us, how innovative is Greater Boston? How did you measure innovative, and how do we compare to some of our peers who also have good reputations in this, like New York or San Francisco?
Yeah, well, many large cities have developed a few major innovations and some a good deal. However, we found that the sheer number of innovations from here, as you mentioned, is huge. There are more than 400 innovations which originated here and have changed the nation of the world. No other city in the United States comes close on this. Baltimore has listed about 75, and they seem to be the closest, and probably is the same for other global cities. I think probably that a lot of us living in Massachusetts have had little idea how much in the lead Boston has. So what we have found in our book, Boston Made, really takes your breath away when you're looking at the breadth of it.
So one of the things that was intriguing to me, so I've long sort of thought of Boston as America's civic incubator. And in reading your book, you have a very ecumenical view of what innovation is. So talk to us about how you defined innovation and this broad range of innovations that you're really giving Greater Boston credit for.
Well, many people define innovation really around technology, and that's one silo, as I would say. But innovation is also seen by a lot of people as healthcare, and then others around education, around finance, and around what many of us in the innovation area call social innovations, which are innovations which change the norms of society, like Massachusetts is the first state to have abolished slavery. And so I see them all as having similarities. And the more one, the more I've studied this, the more I've been a believer that the innovations and the people doing the innovations actually reinforce each other along the way, so that to separate out just the technology or just the healthcare really leaves you not understanding what a city is that has a great deal of innovation as part of the basic culture of the city, which is what we do in Boston, in Massachusetts. Yeah.
And you have a wide range of examples. We're going to get into details in a little bit, but everything
sure.
from, you know, vulcanized rubber to the first constitution. But before we grab a couple of examples, briefly take us through, this was interesting, the specific conditions you believe exist here that make us so fertile for innovation.
So there are five drivers, as I like to call them, or conditions, as you mentioned them. We found these by looking through 50 out of the 400 innovations and seeing what was it that made those specific innovations happen and happen in Boston. And we looked at about 25 different reasons, from it's all the university stupid. You know, that's why it's we have 60 in Greater Boston. But we came out with, after studying each of these 50 innovations and why they happened, these five drivers. One was that you needed a dynamic entrepreneur or group of entrepreneurs who were willing to jump through an amazing number of hoops to make that innovation happen. They couldn't do it alone, and most didn't try. And by entrepreneur, it can be the leader of a not-for-profit, it can be a mayor of a city, you know, but somebody who is entrepreneurial, who wants to change things. Second, a vibrant network of people with various talents who usually work with the inventor, sometimes directly and sometimes just part of a cluster of people. Third, that in this in our city, we have had over a long time early adopters of new things that get invented. And they like to buy the new thing really fast, more than we think in other cities. So local demand or early adoption. Fourth, local funding, which is happened with the Puritans who had some wealthy Puritans and has happened more recently with what we call venture capital. And then last is we are very good at taking our innovations, whether they're a service or a product, and selling them to people around the nation and the globe. We're particularly good at that. So those are the five.
We start narrow, but we can build to a big market, is what you're saying.
We're good at that, and we have had, partly from being a port city for a long time and a well-airported city now, we're good at maintaining that, yeah. So,
all right, so
out of these five, we, as those of us studying, came to call it the bump and connect. Four out of five of those drivers are local, and the four or five are sort of intertwined. They don't happen, the innovation doesn't happen if two or three of them are the only ones happening and one or two other big ones aren't.
You need them all.
Yeah.
So let's there's so many examples we could choose.
Sure.
Given what you just said, let's pick a then and now, because you talk about what will come out of medicine and healthcare. You talk about the smallpox vaccination, which Cotton Mather basically took the idea and credit for the idea from an enslaved person in his household.
Yeah.
And then that, of course, now we've got Moderna, which is a local company pioneering a vaccine for COVID-19. So take us back to the smallpox vaccine and play that out briefly for us.
The smallpox vaccine, sure. Anisimus, who is an African who was brought to the Caribbean and then to Boston as a slave and bought by this Cotton Mather, who was the most powerful Puritan in the city at the time. Anisimus was questioned by Cotton Mather in the beginning of a smallpox epidemic that happened in Boston in 1721. Boston at the time was the largest city in the largest town in North America and the third largest port in the British Empire. We're at the center of a lot of things. In any case, Mather asked Anisimus, how come you didn't have smallpox? So many of African slaves coming here came here with smallpox. And Anisimus talked about that in his tribe in Africa, the Garamantese, as they were called at the time, that you were inoculated or variolated was the word that was used with a little bit of the pus that was taken from somebody who had smallpox, and a cut was made in your arm and they put the pus in, and that helped to give most people who had that ability to withstand smallpox. And he said,
and then
that
Mather
he never
did
had
that here, right? And Mather then did that here, right?
Well, Mather didn't do it here, but there was a local country doctor in Boston named Zebdiel Boylston, who had a farm and also treated people. His farm was near where Government Center is now. And so it was Boylston who said in the midst of this pretty bad smallpox epidemic, I want to try to variolate some of these people the way I heard from Mather and Anisimus what they did. And so they did variolate a good number of people. And after the epidemic was over about a year later, Boylston, who had taken a lot of heat for doing this, as did Mather. I mean, they threw grenades through Mather's window, Jeez. The opponents of it, and the majority of the population didn't like what was going on, and listening to an African slave about science was really considered the sort of thing that shouldn't be done in Boston. But Boylston was willing to. What they found is that one out of 12 people who who got smallpox in Boston at the time died of it during that epidemic. But only one in 40 who got variolated died of smallpox.
So the
difference was huge. Yeah.
I'm going to have to wrap us up there. So I guess I'm understanding part of the lesson is this spirit of experimentation and the ability to carry it out through these bump and connect factors. That is Framingham State University Professor Robert Krim, founder of the Boston History and Innovation Collaborative. He is the author with Alan Earls of the new book Boston Made, From Revolution to Robotics, Innovations That Changed the World. Professor Krim, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Tiziana.
And listeners, next week we're going to do more on this. We'll be speaking with the Boston Globe's Scott Kirstner about his new book on Boston's innovation economy. We'll be back in a minute. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. With 144 women currently serving in the Senate and the House of Representatives, the 117th Congress has set a new record. 27% of congressional seats are now held by women. Now, while that's obviously still a far lower percentage than the general population, it is an increase of 50% from just a decade ago. It's also important to note, though, that the United States has not always led the way on women's rights.
From the Pacific Coast to the North Sea, things began to happen on the now quiescent front of women's rights. By 1915, Finland, Norway, Iceland, and Denmark had joined New Zealand and Australia in extending the franchise to women. In the autumn of 1916 in Britain, reform of the franchise laws was begun. By now, there was no doubt about women's right to the ballot.
I think quiescent front of women's rights is going to stick with me. Now, conspicuously absent from the list that you just heard, of course, is the United States. The 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote, wasn't adopted until 1920. As we close out Women's History Month today, we want to revisit, therefore, a conversation that we had on the show with author and journalist Elaine Weiss, talking about her book, The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. And despite this being very much a national or even international story that unfolded across decades, Weiss's book tells the story of a very specific regional battle, the fight to ratify the 19th Amendment in the Tennessee state legislature. Three quarters, 36 of the 48 states at the time would have to ratify the 19th Amendment for it to pass. And with 35 states voting to ratify, the movement keyed in on Tennessee as the last best chance to gain the right to vote for women across the country.
This is the last battle for the last state needed to ratify the 19th Amendment to make it enter the Constitution, which would give the vote to every woman in every election in every state for the first time. And this is 35 states had ratified. They need 36 or three quarters of the 48 states in the Union. And this climactic battle really crystallizes all the themes, all the arguments, all the nastiness of the seven decades of fighting for the vote that came before. So it was a great front story for me to focus on, and then allowed me to pull the camera back and show the full movement and how it arrived in Tennessee.
Yeah, it's always important to consider historical context. Can you talk a little bit about what was going on at the time? World War I had just ended a couple years earlier. There's a presidential election on the horizon. How did all those things kind of play into this?
Sure, they all played in. Sometimes we think of women's suffrage, if we think of it at all, because we often don't know very much about it, that it just was a little bubble floating in the historical horizon. It just happened. Men saw the light. They gave women the vote. And the tenacity of the women who had to fight for this for seven decades in America was is really quite remarkable. So it comes down to this final push in the summer of 1920. There is a presidential election, as you mentioned. It's pivotal because America has just come out of World War I. It's trying to decide its role in the world, whether it's going to be isolationist or it's going to be a leader of the free world. There's great anxiety about immigration. There's anxiety about labor. There are many labor strikes, a sense of inequality in our economic system.
This is sounding very familiar.
Yes, it is. It's really strikingly familiar. There's a lot of racial tension. So it's a time that's very, very fraught. And to have this big change, the largest expansion of our democracy in history come about right now in 1920 makes it even more unpredictable.
I think one of the things I was struck by as I was going through the book is kind of the power and influence of female leaders in the anti-suffrage movement. I mean, that's kind of, on its face, you just kind of say, wait, what? Can you talk a little bit about their role?
Well, I was truly shocked when, in my research, I came upon some of the strongest opposition to giving women the vote came from other women. And, of course, this is something for us to think about now. Women are not monolithic in their thinking, in their politics, or in their cultural thoughts about how society should be structured. And women's suffrage was going to change women's role in society. And so some of these women saw it as a real threat to the American family, to the American moral system. That's how they phrased it. They thought there were cartoons that showed America when feminized, and it warned of a downfall of the American family. Men were going to be emasculated. Women were going to wear the pants if they could have the right to vote. So these women, for a whole galaxy of reasons, were very, very opposed. And they organized, and they were strong, and they had great influence. Of course, they were in the minority, but they were a strong minority. And you could say, how could they work against what we would consider women's best interests?
Yeah, self-interests.
Exactly. But that does happen, as we know from modern history.
Yeah. I think a factor that gets overlooked sometimes when we're talking about the suffrage movement is racism. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you can give us a little context for how that played in.
Yeah, racism is threaded through the movement. I should say race is threaded through the movement, because the women's rights movement actually comes out of the abolition movement in the middle of the 19th century. And so the women we think of as suffrage foremothers are really abolition workers. At the beginning, they're working with Frederick Douglass, who also supports women's rights as well as rights for enslaved black people. So these two movements actually are siblings for a long, long time. Race enters into it when, after the Civil War, the women are told, no, 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 the nation cannot take two big reforms at once. You're going to have to wait. The woman's hour will have to wait. And so there's this tension of who gets the vote and who doesn't get the vote. And this is something we should think about today, because there are still citizens who are being denied or the vote being made more difficult for them. And what happens, what I saw also, of course there's racism among some women in the movement. It's a racist society, especially 19th and early 20th century. But also in Nashville, when my story takes place, there's a huge push of racist rhetoric used against the suffragists, saying, you know, the 19th Amendment is going to allow black women to vote, and we can't allow that.
It's a fascinating dichotomy, because you have these women who are fighting for progress on the one hand, but kind of bowing to the racism of the times on mm-hmm. the other. How did you think about that as you're writing these characters? Is this a hero? Is this mm-hmm. How did you kind of grapple with that?
I did have to grapple with it. You want your characters, especially such idealistic, hardworking, believing in America and democracy kind of characters, to be perfect, and they're not. But they are also, I think, when we see some of the racist rhetoric that they employ in order to get the amendment passed, they tell the Southern senators and legislators, don't worry, there's more white women than black women. It won't rock the boat. They use that kind of argument as a political expediency. And is that something we should cheer? No. But we should understand why they were doing it, too. But they're also, again, it's the anti-suffrage movement that really uses racism to get its point across.
But it is prevalent on both sides. I have to ask you kind of a tough question. You know, mm-hmm. there's a Machiavellian element here. Did the end justify the means in your mind?
Well, the 19th Amendment would, I think, not have passed in the states for ratification, nor in the Congress, if they had not salved some of the fears of racist Southern congressmen and Southern legislators. So whether this small step of getting women the vote, hopefully, the 19th Amendment is race blind. It does say all women would get the vote.
Right.
It was how it was implemented in the Southern states, especially in the North. Black women could vote in the West. In the Southern states, it's the Jim Crow laws and it's the black codes, which prevent women from voting. And Congress did not enforce, it's given powers of enforcement, did not enforce the 19th Amendment. So who's to blame for really the sad outcome of black women getting the vote legally with the 19th Amendment, but not being able to exercise it?
All right, so we've spoiled the ending a little bit, but I'm going to ask you to read a passage it's describing Carrie Catt as she's waiting to hear the result of the vote in Nashville.
Right. So Carrie Catt is the leader of the mainstream women's suffrage organization, the National American Women's Suffrage. Alice Paul is head of the more radical wing. And Carrie Catt has spent 6 weeks in Nashville, miserable 6 weeks. She's being held basically under house arrest in the Hermitage Hotel, which overlooks the State House, because her presence would be so inflammatory as a Northern suffragist that they just keep her hidden. And she runs the campaign from her hotel room. So this is the morning of the vote. It's August 18th, 1920. The vote is about to take place in the House of the Legislature, and Carrie is sitting by her window. Carrie Catt again kept vigil as the open window of her room, straining to hear the periodic bursts of cheering that spilled down from Capitol Hill. The imposing visage of the State House filled Catt's window frame just as it dominated the skyline of the city. In that building, at that moment, her cause and the future of American women was being debated and decided by men. She could only watch. Catt was amused to find the Tennessee suffragists had gotten hold of a replica of the Liberty Bell, that famously cracked symbol of American independence, and installed it in the House chamber this morning, ready to be rung the moment the vote to ratify was won. When it was won, if it was won. For years, in so many of her speeches, Catt had spoken of a moment heralding women's political freedom. The bell of liberty would surely, inevitably ring, she'd say, because there was nothing so powerful, so irresistible as an idea whose time had come. But sometimes, like this morning, she had to wonder. Some men in that State House across the way were undoubtedly making the same arguments against women's suffrage that Susan Anthony had heard. And some women were still frightened or deluded enough to be applauding them. The vote was likely to be excruciatingly close. Even at this late date, there was no firm consensus, no overwhelming mandate for giving women the vote or permitting them full citizenship. She tried not to wonder whether America was ready for the Liberty Bell.
It's staggering to kind of hear that and think about here we are 100 years later. That, as we said, was a decades-long struggle. How are you reflecting on this movement and the progress we've made over a century?
Well, I wrote this book. I finished it just before the 2016 election. And I, in the time since, I didn't realize that there would be so many relevant issues. Everything from, these are citizens, these are ordinary women who organize themselves and take to the streets. They march. They picket. They protest. And then, of course, comes the Women's March of, again, ordinary women protesting government policies. And it really gave me a moment to wonder how history repeats itself. This is, again, a cry from American citizens saying our rights are not being protected. We're not even considered full citizens. And here we are at a time when we're questioning rights of citizenship, voting rights, women's rights, press freedom, all these rights we've taken for granted, and suddenly they seem shakier and endangered again. So it meant a lot to me in the midterm elections when a few of my readers wrote to me and said, you know, I carried your book into the polling place with me for inspiration. We need this history now.
That was author and journalist Elaine Weiss talking with Radio Boston's Chris Sitterick back in March of 2019. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Walter Wolfman, and we have help from Stephen Gelman. Our engineer today is Renee Marchando. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.